Confidence is the idea that you know that you can try something, and even if you fail, everything is going to be okay.
Did you ever feel like what you learned in law school didn't prepare you for the world of running a law practice? Law school didn't teach us how to start our practices the right way so that we could scale them into a thriving business. We didn't learn how to make sure that our businesses would meet our financial goals and provide the type of lifestyle we deserve. After 10 years, I was fed up with struggling in my practice and decided to begin a journey to scaling a successful practice that would actually allow me to finally live the life I've always dreamed of. I invite you to listen in on the conversations I'm having with some of the most successful solo and small firm practitioners, along with leading business entrepreneurs, and share how I am implementing what I am learning, all with the goal of helping you take control of your practice and your life. This is The Law Entrepreneur. Hey there, fellow law entrepreneurs. Welcome to, ta-da, episode 200 of The Law Entrepreneur. I'm Neil Tyree, your host. 200 episodes. Can you believe it? I can't, honestly. If you had told me 4 years ago that we'd still be going strong, in fact, getting stronger, I would have said you were crazy. But here we are, 4 years later and 200 episodes in, and we've been lucky enough to experience steady growth along the way and continued interest in the show. So we're going to keep doing it. Surprise, surprise. But I want to take a couple of minutes before we get started here to thank some folks without whom this could not be possible. You know, first and foremost, I need to thank our sponsors. You know, currently our sponsors are Ruby Receptionists and Jurisdiction, and they've been with us for quite some time now. But I don't want to forget that in the beginning, we had the support of folks like Spotlight Branding and Daylight by Market Circle. And I'm terribly indebted to their encouragement and their support of the podcast in the early days because it really made it possible to continue to do. And then, you know, the podcast would not be what it is without some phenomenal guests. I mean, these people who have been on the show by and large are just brilliant. You know, they're often very entertaining, informative, and most of all, giving to our audience. I think I can say without hesitation that, you know, everyone who's been on the show has had something to offer and something to give, and unconditionally, you know, and we're all better off for it. So thank you to my wonderful guests. And, you know, this is a group that, you know, doesn't get a lot of recognition, but my producers. The folks at Crate Media out in Ohio, I often tell the guests in our pre-recording calls or conversations that I have these great producers out in Ohio led by Cody Boyce and the fellas, and they make me sound way better than I have any right to, and they eliminate all the mistakes and the glitches that occur when you do a live recording and, you know, produce a smooth, polished product. So I'm really in debt to Crate Media, and if you're starting a podcast or you know people starting a podcast, check them out. They can make your life a whole lot easier and a whole lot more professional. But last but not least, you know, it really couldn't be possible to have 200 episodes without you, the listeners. You know, you've been with me from the very beginning. You've helped spread the word about the podcast, and you've forgiven my errors along the way, and you really are why I do this. I love the continued support. It's really just a kick every time I go somewhere, you know, as the law entrepreneur, and somebody recognizes me and says, you know, how much the podcast means to them. It's just so supportive and so encouraging. And so, you know, thank you, thank you, thank you. And let's hope we have another 4 years together, okay? Now on to episode 200. I knew as we started to approach this number that I really wanted to have a special guest for the 200th episode. And so my friend Derek Coburn, You've heard me mention him before. He leads a group here in the DC area called Cadre DC. If you want to know what Derek's all about, listen to, get this, episode 5 of The Law Entrepreneur. So I'm really a bad friend. I need to get Derek back on the program, back on the show here, because he has a lot more to offer than what we just covered way back when I didn't really know what I was doing as a podcaster. But I shared with Derek that I was looking to have, you know, a special guest, and Derek put his money where his mouth is and made the suggestion that I have Jordan Harbinger as our guest. And I jumped at that opportunity because I have a personal connection to Jordan, although he doesn't know it. He's going to find out here shortly. And Jordan was a real influence when I started getting into podcasts. So I jumped on that possibility. Derek was able to make the introduction. And here we go. We have Jordan Harbinger as our guest. Now, if you don't know who Jordan is, I can tell you that he is one of the most influential podcasters in the podcasting space. He's one of the reasons that I do this, because way back when I started listening to podcasts, there were a handful of shows that I listened to religiously, and Jordan's was one of them. At that time, he hosted or co-hosted a show called The Art of Charm, and it was a brilliant show, wildly popular, as is his current show, The Jordan Harbinger Show. And, you know, metrics aren't always a good measure of how influential and how important a podcast is, but suffice it to say, with 4.5 million downloads a month, the Jordan Harbinger Show is one of the leading podcasts in the world. I know Apple in 2018 voted it one of the best. They may have done so in 2019. I don't remember. I didn't look, but I do remember in 2018, it was voted one of the best podcasts of all time. And I listen to it religiously to this day. And I encourage you to do so as well. I think you'll hear in our discussion, you know, Jordan is just covers a lot of material and has a lot to say about, about personal development and the like. And here's the connection. He's an attorney, went to law school at the University of Michigan Law School, practiced law in New York City before he embarked on his podcasting career. And we won't go into too much of that because I wanted to get to some other areas of discussion, but you'll get a pretty good sense of how he traversed the legal space and came to be where he is today. So I am delighted to have you join me in my conversation on our episode 200 of The Law Entrepreneur with Jordan Harbinger. Jordan Harbinger, welcome to episode 200 of The Law Entrepreneur.
Thanks for having me on, man. I appreciate the opportunity.
Well, nobody appreciates it more than I do, Jordan. Our audience has already been having to succumb to a long-winded intro that I did regarding my fanboy appeal of you and your show. But one of the things I think that people who do know you may not be aware of the fact is you started off in this very same profession. You went to law school, you practiced law. Tell our audience a little bit about that experience and really how that came to be in the past.
Sure. So I became a lawyer for the reason that many people become lawyers, which is I had absolutely no idea what I wanted to do with myself and had trouble getting a job out of college. Stop me if this sounds familiar.
No. Everybody's raising their hand here.
And becoming a lawyer, as you know, is one of those things where all your family members that have never even met a lawyer in their entire life think you'd be good at it because you argued with them once when you were a teenager, right, and therefore you should become an attorney. So that was kind of like, oh, Aunt Arlene, who's like a gym teacher, told me I should do this. So now I'm going to apply to law school because she said those people are successful and then you can become a politician, which I had no ambition to do whatsoever. And I don't know what you would say. I guess I went through the motions, actually quite enjoyed law school at Michigan. got lucky to even get into law school at Michigan, felt really outgunned at law school at Michigan, you know, because it was one of those, oh, wow, okay, everyone is really smart here. Because I went to Michigan for undergrad and I thought, I'm kind of in the middle of the pack. I'm getting pretty good grades. I'll just go to Michigan Law. And my dad's like, yeah, good idea. It's really convenient. Now, maybe in the 80s, 70s, 60s, you could go to a law school in an area that was quote unquote convenient and you picked colleges based on where you lived or where you were going to live. Now, as you know, law school is people will fly from Israel to go to law school in Michigan. They'll fly from New York to go to law school at Michigan because of the way the rankings work, which is a whole nother sort of baloney thing that sort of don't even get me started.
Yeah.
So I went there thinking, oh, well, it's going to be kind of like undergrad in terms of the caliber of people. And Michigan has great people in grad and undergrad, but holy schmoly, was Michigan Law really tough. I mean, the people there were world-class in every way. And I'm not trying to give myself a compliment here, kind of the opposite. I will tell you, I was so effing outgunned. I mean, I showed up there and people were just like, yeah, I was the valedictorian and then I played varsity football and then I used to be a professional wrestler and then I was an Air Force pilot and then I left that to join the CIA and now I'm going to law school. And I'm like, yeah, I just graduated with a degree that basically was made up so I didn't have to take math classes.
And worked and over the summer.
And I worked over the summer at like a movie theater. You know, like I just did not have the chops. And I can tell people were kind of like, nice to meet you. Next, you know, where are the smart people? Like, you know, and I thought this is going to be impossible. Luckily, what I found was that my competitive advantage, which used to be like, oh, I'm kind of clever, can teach myself geometry before the quiz, you know, that kind of thing. That was gone. But then my competitive advantage in college and then especially in law school became, I can just work really hard. You know, if I can work 16 hours a day and everyone else craps out after six, I'm going to at least pass. And I graduated in, I think, the top third of the class or something like that. And that, for me, was just a miracle. And candidly, I'm not even sure how I pulled it off. It was literally just the 14 to 16 hour days along with what turned out to be one of my greatest skills, which was networking, because I made friends with the super smart kids who on the first day were like, who wants to be in a study group? And I was like, me, because no one else is going to want to be in a group with me. So I'm going to take what I can get. And so all of, we call them gunners. They were like, yeah, we're in a group. And I was like the dummy who got into the group. And I somehow managed to convince them that them teaching me everything we learned in class that week, whenever we met or the last few days, was great for them to learn, which now we know through brain science actually is
a
great way for them to learn. And so they said it was helpful. I thought they were just being nice to me, but they were teaching me everything they could teach me. And I now at age 40 realize, oh, right. I'm not good at staring at a professor and reading a legal case. I do need someone to explain it to me. And it's not because I'm defective. It's because I have a different learning style than somebody who sits there and reads legal cases and digests points through, I don't know, osmosis. So I was able to learn that way from friends. And turns out that's a highly effective way for pretty much anyone to teach and learn. And also a highly effective way for me personally to ace really, really hard tests that were literally 100% of our grade. Because I don't think people didn't go to law school, what they might not realize is at a school, or at least at law school in Michigan, the final exam was 100% of your grade. Not like 90, not like 80, 50, whatever. Some teachers would make it impossible for you to get an A if you didn't show up to class, but they would make it 100% of your grade, give or take. And you could maybe get some bonus points by showing up like every day for certain teachers. But
and then you try and run that gauntlet after you've gone through law school, that gauntlet of trying to get a job. And there's a whole different skill set. And once you do get a job, it's a different learning experience altogether, because then you realize that, well, law school really didn't teach me what I needed to do
be
an effective attorney.
It's 100% true. And to be candid again, I didn't even, we had this thing called off camp or on campus recruiting, where all these firms, this is 2006, 2007. So the economy was kicking butt. And so companies and programs and nonprofits and firms, they would come to campus, rent out a whole motel somewhere off campus, whatever, set up interviews. And our career services place they decided they were going to make it quote unquote fair. 2020 hindsight, it was a little ridiculous, but I get what they were going for. You had to sign up for interviews and they would assign who you could interview with. You couldn't just show up, wait in line, take an interview, da da da. They wanted it to be quote unquote fair and equal opportunity, which is a very Michigan thing to do. And I didn't sign up for anything. And my friends were like, ooh, who's your first choice? Who is your second choices? Who is your third choice? And I went, I didn't sign up. And people went, are you insane? And I actually arbitraged this in a funny way. I signed up for my close friends' first, second, and third choices. And they signed up for their second, third, and fourth choices as their first choice. So that basically I gave them my slot. I said, hey, 2:30 p.m., there's going to be a no-show at Latham and Watkins. You better get in line. And so they would do that. And I sort of like sold those slots to good friends of mine. I can't even remember if I got anything in return. But one of my friends who I did that for goes, hey, my old roommate's friend, Jeremy, is in room 231. You should go say hi, which now I realize is super good networker parlance for go ask him for a favor because you didn't get an interview at his firm. You know, and they send the Michigan grads back to sort of be there for some of the off-campus interviews or on-campus interviews. So I went to that room and I said, hey, Jeremy, what's up? And he goes, oh, hey, what's up, Jordan? Neil, give me your resume. And I said, okay. And he goes, I'm going to get you an interview with this firm. And I said, all right, but I haven't prepared. He goes, it doesn't matter. That's even better. Because since I'm doing it as a surprise, you don't have to know anything about the firm. So they're going to forgive the fact that you don't know anything about the firm because it's on the spot. And I was like, okay, that makes sense. They wouldn't have expected me to have researched this. So he goes, and candidly, look, if you get hired, I'm going to get like a Rolex, but I like you and you'd be a good fit for this firm and I would love for you to work here. And I said, great. He goes, I'm going to put in a good word for you. So then the interviewer who's like housing a Subway sandwich goes, oh, are you my 1 o'clock? Is it already one? And I said, no, I'm just here to see Jeremy. And he goes, my friend Jeremy goes, why don't you interview him as long as you don't mind us eating lunch? And I said, no, go ahead. So over a submarine sandwich while he was eating, I wasn't, he, and I put this in very strong, bold air quotes, interviewed me, which was like, so how do you know Jeremy? Oh, cool. What are you studying? What kind of law do you want to do? I don't know. Would you ever live in New York? Yeah, I love New York. Great. Well, that's all I need for now. And I walked out of there with my head hanging low because I went, wow, he really thought I was a schmo. He asked me like 5-10 questions max for, you know, 8 minutes, 10 minutes. And Jeremy goes, I think you crushed it. And I was like, you don't have to lie to me. Before I even left the building, there was a callback from the HR office in New York offering to fly me out to New York the following week for my follow-up interviews. That's when I realized not only did Jeremy get me in the door, but all these on-campus interviews, the whole thing was, can we stand this person or are they so irritating we don't even want them breathing our oxygen? And yeah, once they see your grades and they find out that they can deal with you more than 5 minutes, you're in, man. That was it.
Yeah, it's a totally bizarre, you know, process by which you go through all of that. And the whole idea that you have to have your grade average set at your first semester, first year, because, you know, if you don't crush it that first semester, there's almost no recovery. You know, the whole process is bizarre. But ultimately, you did go and worked in New York City and you worked in big law for a time, correct?
Yeah, I worked in big law and for a time it was not a long time. I chose real estate finance at a firm that no longer exists. So I'm going to say their name because I think it's probably fine. They don't exist. Thatcher, Proffitt, and Wood. Great for, I loved them. I thought working there was a lot of fun. I know I sound like a dummy who doesn't try hard, but that's not the case. I worked my butt off in law school and I worked my butt off at this firm for as long as I could. The people were really nice. In fact, I'm still friends with a dozen of them and we hang out every year. It was one of the best experiences I've ever had. And I'm really glad that I'm not still a lawyer, especially at a big law firm. But it was a joy working there. Unfortunately, I had picked real estate finance, which if I'd been more switched on, I might have realized that was a bubble that wasn't going to last long. But at the time, I just thought, well, yes, I would like to make $160,000 a year plus bonus for my first job out of college, right? Because my job I had before this was at a movie theater making $575 an hour. So,
and that was in like, what, 2009, 10, that area?
This is 2006, 2007.
A little earlier, okay.
It was before the crash. So I worked there for a year, not even. And then it was like, hey, I don't have any work. And then it was like, hey, I don't have any work. Are you sure you're not just going to fire me? And then it was, hey, nobody has any work. What's going on? And they said, don't worry, it's going to recover by May. And meanwhile, it's like February. And I go, so what do we do? And they just said, look, study. If you want to pass the New Jersey bar, since you already got the New York bar, you can study for that. We'll pay for it. You know, like if you want to learn how to do XYZ, we'll pay for it. Or you can just come to the office and help out with other divisions work. And so some people are getting retrained and moving to different offices, doing this, that, and the other thing. I was more like, I'm running this podcast and I'm just going to not do anything, which is what most people did. They would pitch in on big deals that other parts of the firm were wrapping up and do diligence and doc review. But like, that was it. And then after May rolled around or June or July, they were like, so here's the deal. We're not going to lay anyone off because that's bad and it's not your fault, but we're going to pay you until like, whatever, December, full salary, full benefits. And then we're probably going to say, we're definitely not hiring. And then we're probably going to have you guys go do something else. We have all these trainers in that are going to help you find other jobs, all these recruiters that are on board. And that was a problem because nobody was hiring. And then Bear Stearns went out of business. And then was it?
Then the roof fell in.
The roof fell in. It doesn't even matter. But that was the Canary was one of our major clients was like, hey, we're going under. And the firm was like, what do you mean? And then the whole that firm lasted one more year after that and then completely wrapped up, 141 years old or something like that. And they wrapped up completely. They were too leveraged. But they gave us full salary and benefits. And I took that 9 month, I think it was, runway, and I invested it in my company. And that's why I'm here.
Now, you had obviously started your podcast and your company. You had the entrepreneurial spirit at that point. You'd also had been practicing law. Did you ever consider going to practice for yourself as a solo or as a small firm?
No, I totally didn't even have the confidence to do that. You know, I was still at the juncture in my career where I realized I don't think I can do anything on my own. But what would I possibly do? Bear in mind, before that, when you work for a big firm, you're doing the stuff that they won't ask your secretary to do because it's a waste of her time. You know, they're like, here's an 800 page prospectus for an oil and gas deal in Dubai. Read this and look for mistakes. And you'd be like, oh, this font is weird. There's a comma missing. Hey, these page numbers are duplicated. I mean, that's what I was doing. This is stuff that I think robots do now, but exactly. That's what I was doing. And so to be like, you know what? I'm going to go ahead and work for myself was a ludicrous idea. It would have been completely irresponsible for me to do that. I don't think I could have fought a parking ticket at that juncture law career.
At the same time, you were working for yourself because you had launched your original podcast.
Right. But that was kind of like, at the time, 2020 hindsight, that looked like lower stakes. Okay, so I have to talk into a microphone. Okay, so I have to run an educational seminar. Okay, so I have to coach somebody over the phone on networking or certain types of skills, presentation skills. That was easy enough, but law seemed far too serious and high stakes. And I thought, ooh, you know, if I screw up with a client of mine, they might have a mediocre presentation or something like that. But if I screw up, how am I going to go to court? You know,
the irony behind that is that the skill set that you were developing as a podcaster, business entrepreneur, is the exact skill set that we talk about here on this podcast that attorneys are well advised to develop to build their practice, because those skills are what you need to build a business in the business of law.
That makes sense. Although to somebody who has imposter syndrome and is 27, I wasn't thinking, I got this. I was thinking, I'm lucky to even be in the room.
You didn't see that nexus.
Correct.
Yeah. So let's talk about, you know, one of the things that you have done over the course of the years is talk about the importance of communications. And, you know, for attorneys, the ability to communicate, it's the substance in which we trade. It's what we do. And yet we hear feedback from the public all the time that, you know, attorneys don't communicate properly, that they speak in legalese, they talk over the client's head. God knows we have enough attorneys who every time they open their mouth sound pompous and arrogant. If looking back now on your experience in the legal world and what you know about attorneys today and what you advocate in terms of developing your style and your ability to communicate in an authentic way, what do you think attorneys could do to improve those skills and overcome that perception?
Well, I think one of the major issues with anyone, but with attorneys especially, is when you are the one who is well-versed in a topic area, such as whatever field of law you're in, and then you've got someone else who is not that well-versed, but is emotionally attached to the outcome, it's really tempting to talk down to that person because you think it will calm them down, right? So you get, I don't know if that's what people think. That's one rationale. So you get people who are like, oh, well, I mean, it can't possibly be that this is BS. You know, I didn't even do it. I didn't even hit that person's car, to use a simplified example. Yeah, I didn't even hit them. And then, you know, she's saying that I did, and this is crap. You know, I'm not even going to go to court because this is garbage. I don't want to entertain this. You know, you hear stuff like that all the time. Or I'm just going to tell everybody that this is a lie. And, you know, it's tempting to sort of talk down to those people or speak in a very confident way. But I think a lot of attorneys are, and any professional, is used to being right because they are often right, and is often used to dealing with other professionals in that area. And so, yeah, if you're an attorney talking with another attorney and you know that you're right, or it's better to argue very zealously for your perspective. And sometimes that turns into mistaking confidence for arrogance, being bold instead of confident, and doing things like that, that makes sense. And of course, when you add the element of attorneys being well compensated and also having a trump card for the legal system in many ways, you get insecure people saying things like, well, I'm just going to threaten a lawsuit anytime I'm mildly unhappy about something. And that can go to people's heads as well. It can be kind of a drug. But you have to be really careful, because I've noticed doctors are also kind of bad at this sometimes, but they know the value of being good at having a good bedside manner. So I've worked with a lot of attorneys in litigation, both professionally and as a client. And I can tell you, even really well-meaning attorneys can do things that can leave you sleepless for an entire week. I'll give you a short example. I was litigating something and I remember one attorney saying, yeah, well, I mean, you know, if they pull this one off, then, you know, it would be tough to do your podcast. And I said, oh my gosh, they can take my show? And he goes, no, you know, it's hard to say. I don't have a crystal ball. So I didn't sleep for like 4 days. I couldn't get a hold of him. After 4 days, he said, I'm so sorry. I was in a trial and it was just bonkers. And then my wife got sick. And I said, I haven't slept. I'm ragged. I'm worried they're going to take my show. And he goes, oh no, I mean, after, they would only be able to ask you to stop doing it if they paid off your share of the company, and then you agreed to sign a non-compete, but they'd have to buy your shares out at a full value for that. And I was like, oh, so they'd have to give me like $3 million and then I wouldn't be able to do it. I could probably figure out how to pivot, or I would give them $1 million back and continue doing my show. And he's like, yeah. And I was thinking to myself, why didn't you tell me that 3 days ago? I haven't eaten. I haven't slept. My wife hasn't slept. We're up at 4 a.m. Googling things. This is awful, you know? And he's like, oh, sorry about that. You know, it was awful. And then I've had other attorneys say things like, you know, no matter what, you're a smart guy. You're going to come out of this on top. I have no doubt about it. Here's what could happen. This, and this. But this, and that are more likely. And the worst case scenario that I just outlined, not only is it unlikely, it's at least 2 years out because that's how long this is going to take. And well,
it surprises me that attorneys don't spend more time improving their communication skills.
Bedside manner.
Yeah.
It's not that hard.
It's not that hard. And, you know, I think the general public at first, because of television and movies, they think of, you know, all attorneys as being glib, articulate, you know, orators. But the real eye opener is when you go to your first day in a regular circuit court, you know, your local court, and hear attorneys making presentations before the court, particularly if they're in front of a jury, and you recognize, oh my goodness, this person needs some real help in communicating and organizing their thoughts and being able to speak in a coherent way. And I think you have done a lot with your clients and with your audience to help develop that understanding of the ability to communicate as being important.
Yeah, I think it's just as important. I know this is kind of strange, but I'd rather have an attorney who communicated really well, was really conscientious, and had good quote-unquote bedside manner than an attorney that just had maybe the best reputation and was scaring opposing counsel, because I think we all kind of know you pay for that. And also, opposing counsel knows the real deal. You might be believing the marketing, but you might be a small fish in a big pond. Like working with a big name attorney, you might not get any attention. And if they're scaring you and keeping you up all night and then billing you $10,000 a month for the privilege, you're not really gaining anything. I've been in litigation as an entrepreneur, it's a reality. I've been in litigation with somebody who hired a really blustery attorney. And I'll be honest, it hasn't worked out in their favor very much. Like initially I was really annoyed and scared and they were getting their way because they were so hard to work with. But later on I realized that attorney was running up legal fees that were easily 3 to 4 times what I was paying in the same litigation, which, as you know, the name of the game is who burns out quicker in a lot of these cases.
Oftentimes that is the case. You started your law practice to ditch the firm life and be your own boss, but your practice is running you. The good news, being an attorney entrepreneur doesn't have to be this hard. Jesse and Megan, the lawpreneurs behind Jurisdiction, are working to build a new generation of solo practitioners who love being lawyers. This year, Jurisdiction is introducing a new program, Next Level Law Practice. Next Level Law Practice is a rigorous training program that provides the tools and business fundamentals for estate planning attorneys to start and grow a profitable and streamlined legal business. Next Level Law Practice gives you access to videos, worksheets, templates, one-on-one coaching, and live group sessions that allow you to ask questions and learn on your own schedule. To learn more about the program, visit thrivejd.com. That's thrivejd.com. They're even offering an exclusive coupon code for the Law Entrepreneur listeners. Just enter the code TLE150, that's like the Law Entrepreneur 150, for a $150 discount off your course registration. And welcome to the show, Jurisdiction. Support for today's episode comes from Ruby Receptionists, dedicated to helping you grow your practice one happy caller at a time. From their offices in Portland, Oregon, Ruby's live remote receptionists create an exceptional experience for your callers by answering calls live with your custom greeting, delighting callers in English or Spanish, transferring calls, taking messages, collecting new client intake, and much more. Just like an in-house receptionist at a fraction of the cost. For 15 years, Ruby has been turning rings into relationships. For more information, call 844-895-7829 or visit callruby.com/lawentrepreneur. Now, I want to go back to something you said earlier and you alluded to as being a component of your success as an entrepreneur. And you spoke about networking and its value in creating opportunities for yourself. And in fact, I know you spent a lot of time teaching folks, you know, an approach to networking. And in fact, I want to go ahead and plug your networking course that you have. But for attorneys, networking is one of the primary, if not the primary method that most folks point to in terms of how to grow their practice. And yet so few know how to go about networking in a productive way. They kind of think of it as a volume-based business. And we try and get folks to orient themselves around it being a relationship-building business. So can you talk a little bit about what that means and what the difference is between handing out your business cards in a million places and building a, you know, a quality relationship for networking?
Yeah, I think this is a misconception that is quite prevalent among people who look at, who people even hear the word networking and they say things like, oh, you know, I don't like it. And when I give talks about networking, even at companies like Google, where people theoretically may know better, kind of, networking is a dirty word. People really hate the idea that they have to do it. They think of networking as, all right, I paid $20. I'm going to this mixer, or it was free. I'm parking at the YMCA downtown. I'm going to this mixer. And, you know, they sit down and they've got their really cheapo business cards that everyone else is handing them about financial planning and used car salesmen or whatever the hell. And then you've got, you really get annoyed by everybody else that's around you. Everybody just wants something from you and you're irritated. And there's a lot of just like, I call them like cheap suits, kind of handing out like, hey, when you want to retire, what are you going to do with your money? And you're like, man, real talk, I'm eating a stale cookie and drinking Kool-Aid out of a styrofoam cup. Who are you?
Yeah.
You know, who are you? So I don't blame people for not liking that. Or we only see the examples of networking that are negative and directed at us. So it's the, hey, Neil, what's going on, man? It's been such a long time since high school. And you're like, oh my gosh, Jordan, what's going on? Been 25 years. And I'm like, yeah, how are the kids? Here's what I'm doing. What are you doing? And we're talking and you're thinking, wow, this is really nice. I'm catching up with an old friend. And then I go, have you ever heard of Scientology? Or yeah. Have you ever heard of Herbalife? You get to make money from home. And you're like, ah, this whole thing was a ruse. I hate you. Why did you waste my time? I'm so annoyed. I'm so stupid for falling for this. You just wanted something. I hate every minute of this. So that's what people think of when they think networking, and they're like, I will never do that.
Well, they think of networking in the same vein as going to the dentist.
Yes. And they think it's like being sold to, and they're like, I don't want to have to sell something to somebody else that person doesn't want. And that's not what networking actually is. You know, relationship development, the best rule for this is, I think this is like a Zig Ziglar type of quote or Brian Tracy. It's always, help other people get what they want and they'll help you get what you want. And that's really good. I'm not much of like a self-help junkie these days, but that's a really good maxim for this, because I spend, and I encourage other people in our 6-minute networking course, which is again free. I encourage other people to do the same thing. I spend a lot of time introducing people to each other, helping people do things that I never expect or anticipate ever getting anything in return. You know, if somebody's like, I really need a web designer, I don't think, good luck, bro, I'm not a web designer. I think, who do I know that's a web designer? Let me plug them in and do the introduction. Or, oh, I'm starting a podcast, what can I do? I need help with this. And I go, I know just the person who can consult on starting a new show that knows what they're talking about from my perspective. Let me make that introduction. You know, it's about that. It's not about what's in it for me. And more importantly, I'm not keeping score. So these are two really important things. One, don't think about what's in it for you, because the answer is always, you don't know. And I can give an example of how that works in a minute. Most opportunities are over what I call over the horizon. Neither party can see them coming. They happen later. And then not keeping score is really important, because if you're keeping score, you end up doing things only when you think you're going to get something in return. And then when you don't get something in return, or you don't get the thing that you want in return, you end up poisoning your own relationships. And it's worse than not having the relationship at all. That's the one where I drive you to the airport 3 times and you say, hey, Jordan, thanks for being a good neighbor and driving me to the airport. And then I go, hey, Neil, can you do my will for free? And you're like, oh, I get it. Actually, I can't, because that's a really long process and it's going to take me like days of working with you and your family. And, you know, it's cool that you gave me 3 airport rides, but it's not exactly an even exchange. And then I'm going, that Neil, he's such a jerk. I drove him to the airport 3 times. I'm never helping him again. And you're like, Jordan's a nice guy. We're friends. And then you wonder why I don't say hi to you on my walks anymore. And I let my dog poop on your lawn, right? Because I'm mad at you because I kept score and I have a covert contract with you. In other words, I have an agreement where I kept up my end of the bargain, but you didn't keep your end of the bargain, but you had no idea we were in a bargain at all. It's a covert contract. So you didn't know how to perform and you didn't know that you breached, so to speak. So I'm mad at you and you have no idea why. That's worse than us not helping each other at all. So don't keep score, because you will poison the well of your own relationships. And as for the opportunities being over the horizon, the example I always give is when I moved to LA years ago, I had a toothache, and this is before Uber, and I couldn't, taxis were really unreliable. I was didn't have a lot of money. This is like a decade and change ago. And I couldn't find a dentist who would see me in a short period of time. They just kept saying, go to the ER, go to the ER. And I was really scared because I've heard they just tie a string around your tooth and yank it out with a doorknob. So I posted on Facebook or whatever it was at the time. I think it was Facebook. Somebody replied and said, my aunt is a dentist near you. Do you want me to call her? I said, yes, please. I'd never met this person who replied to my post. And I, to this day, still have never met them. They just happened to, it was like a mutual friend, you know, Facebook's privacy settings were a little different back then. And I went and got my tooth taken care of, and it cost me only a few $100. I was really grateful. And the guy sent me his graphic design portfolio. I didn't need graphics. I had no use for him at all. But I think a week or two later, another friend of mine said, do you know a good web designer? And I said, no, I got a graphics guy though, who's really hungry. He's a barista right now making coffee, but here's his portfolio. I've never worked with him, but he seems nice and he's hungry. And so she hired him for an $80,000 a year full-time gig after, of course, working with him for a while. And he got that job because he helped me find a dentist on Facebook. So he had no idea I was going to be able to get him a job. I had no idea I was going to be able to get him a job. And he helped me with no expectation just because he was trying to be helpful. And that's how he ended up lucking his way, skilling his way because of his skills with graphics into that full-time career-changing, life-altering position instead of working at a local Starbucks or whatever. And so neither of us could have seen that coming. But had he gone, you know, I'd like to help this Jordan guy, but I don't really understand what he's going to do for me. So you know what? I'm not going to bother. Right. He would never have gotten that job, and he would who knows what would have happened instead, right? Yeah. So that's why you don't know where opportunities are coming from. So you literally have to, what I call ABG, always be giving instead of ABC, always be closing. Don't be looking at what's in it for you. Be looking at what's in it for other people. And doing that in a scalable, easy enough way that doesn't put you out is the way to build all kinds of opportunities that other people, it looks like a miracle to other people. You look like the luckiest guy in the world.
Now, how do you keep all that straight? You meet all these people, you build deep relationships with them. You know what they do, and when the opportunity comes up, is it just from memory? Oh, I do know a guy, or do you have a tool that you use, or is there a mechanism that helps you identify how you can put person A with person B together, make that introduction?
Yeah, you know. Candidly,
because I'm a gadget guy, I'm always looking for the tool to help me do stuff like that.
Well, for me, it's been a challenge. So I typically try to use my good old-fashioned brain. And I'm not saying that if you don't have it memorized, it's your fault somehow. But what I am saying is that if somebody says, do you have a graphic designer that you know of? And nobody comes to mind, yeah, I would search my email. However, I use something called Contactually, which is a CRM, yep. Kind of like a sales tool. And what that tool does is it keeps track of who I've emailed, how long it's been since we've been in touch. And you can put little notes next to them, like graphic designer. And then you can go in and search that CRM for graphic design, and it will pop out, oh yeah, this person's name is tagged with that. And it sounds like a lot of work, like, oh my God, you're tagging everyone you know, but it's pretty smart. You know, if you email them and you search for graphic, Gmail's also pretty smart. You know, you search your email for graphic design and you don't have to look very far until you find that person. I have yet to meet somebody who knows so many people that they can't keep anyone straight at all. And then if they have a lot of people in their Rolodex like I do, use of a CRM should fix that. I know. It doesn't take a lot, especially with AI and search functions these days, to be able to find folks like that. And of course, being in groups and things like that, like this is how you and I connected, being in groups and saying, does anybody know a graphic designer? They might say, oh yeah, so-and-so. And you go, oh, of course. I just worked with him 3 months ago. I just couldn't remember their name, or I forgot all about that. You know, people who are also well-connected will run in those same circles, they will tend to run in those same circles. So it does get pretty easy when you do it that way. But truthfully, it's about practice. You know, if you introduce somebody to somebody else once, twice a week, you start to be pretty good at remembering who's who. And if you're not, I just do the old email search, because that's how everybody's communicating these days anyway. I don't think The last time I made a phone call to introduce somebody was a bajillion years ago. So everything in my life is basically searchable / indexable by the National Security Agency.
It's interesting that you mentioned Contactually. Contactually is a program near and dear to my heart. The founder of the company that created Contactually is V Band. Was a guest on my show way back in the beginning on episode 4. And it's a local company here in D.C. They've actually recently been sold, but the product is still available and still works great. So, you know, nice plug for our friends V.
Yes,
And his program. So, pivoting here a little bit, one of the blog posts that I read that you wrote really resonated with me. It had to do with goal setting. And you know, I will confess to you that I'm not really good at setting goals or managing two goals. I go through the processes of setting them and trying to break them down into projects and tasks and, you know, doing the whole 3-step, 4-step process. And somewhere along the lines, I lose my steam and I'm not able to, you know, realize those goals as I originally envisioned them. You had an interesting take on goal setting. I wonder if you would share it with our audience a little bit.
Sure. So off the record, I'm not totally sure what you're fishing for here. Do you remember what what we're aiming at? Do you remember something that I said that you'd liked?
Well, I think it was the point that you were making was that goal setting in and of itself is not a worthwhile endeavor, and that you'd be much better off managing to a different set of objectives rather than over, you know, global goals.
Yeah, that sounds about right. I'll just start it from there. You edit these, or hopefully?
Yeah.
Okay. For me, I'm not much of a quote-unquote goal-setting type of person. Like, yes, I have goals. Yes, I have dreams for what I want to do later. Yes, I have some ideas of where I want my business to be and things like that. But I'm much more of a tiny habits type of person and manager where I go, look, my goal is to go to the gym 3 times a week and walk 100 miles a month. My goal is not to have six pack washboard abs or whatever. You know, like my goals are sort of process oriented and not results oriented. I'm sort of making this up on the spot. So if it doesn't make sense, let me know.
Well, no, because that's exactly the point that I think you were making that resonated with me, because it reminded me of another guest that we had and an author, James Clear, wrote a book, Atomic Habits. So it's the same. It's that principle where you work up through your constant improvement through achieving small objectives.
Yeah, and that's useful for a couple of reasons. One, if you are trying to get results, you can always be disappointed. You know, you could go to the gym 365 days that year and you could not lose 15 pounds because you gained a bunch of muscle and you didn't lose and you have failed. But if your goal is to go to the gym and work out 3 times a week, you have accomplished your quote unquote goal, even if your weight or the metric didn't change. And that's better for you anyway. And look, I know some people who run businesses are like, no thanks. My goal or my process oriented goal is not going to be try to make money this year. It's going to be make $200,000 this year. I understand that. But the way that a lot of businesses I've seen fail is, not that they set revenue goals. That's not a way that you fail. They do things like, we need to make this amount of money, and they spend more to hit their goal sheet so that they can quote unquote please their investors or like please their shareholders. And meanwhile, the investors are like, why did we spend $1 million to make 800,000 again? Oh, well, our goal was this. So yes, there's failures of goals, and that doesn't mean that all results-oriented goals are a bad idea. I'm just saying that for me, setting goals has always been process oriented, and it's resulted in me being a hell of a lot happier because I see a lot of entrepreneurs, some with varying levels of experience, saying things like, my goal is to be 7 figures by year 2 and multiple 7 figures by year 3. And then they start to adjust their goals, but then they're afraid to do anything that adjusts too drastically because they feel like they failed, or they do that thing where they tell everybody their goal and then they can't change it. And not to mention, there's plenty of new science now that shows when you tell people your goal, you're less likely to achieve it because you're giving your brain that dopamine hit of bragging about your goal before you've done it. And your body, your brain sort of thinks, I've achieved something. And then you kind of go on with your life watching Netflix. So it's dangerous to do that. Process-oriented goals are a lot better and they keep you on track, which makes you much more likely to achieve your goals. So working on making one sale, but doing certain things that would make one sale every week, that's much better than saying, I need to make 30 sales this year. And then being like, oh my gosh, how do I do that? When you break them down to process-oriented goals, you really have a better chance of achieving those goals. Not to say that you can't have both. Make 30 sales a year, so I do something that will advance me every day to make a sale every week. And then you can miss some of the weeks or every 2 weeks, whatever it is. So process-oriented goals are much better. They keep you happier. They keep you motivated. And ironically, they make you more likely to hit your results-oriented goals. And if you don't hit your results-oriented goals, but you hit your process-oriented goals, so you didn't lose 15 pounds, but you did go to the gym 3 times a week and you feel and look better, you don't go, well, I'm a worthless POS because I didn't achieve my goals. You say, well, I achieved part of my goals. And it just so happens to turn out that that was the important part, the process-oriented goals.
Well, that's what resonated with me. And I thought, you know, that's exactly what I've been looking for because I keep trying to pound my square peg into that round hole and it just doesn't work for me. And I just become more and more frustrated by the inability to set and achieve goals. And I think it's much more relevant for me to do, as you say, to focus on the process and improving that incrementally. And the goals will come along the way. Jordan, I want to wrap up here and talk about one other topical area that interests me about your success along the way. And going all the way back to your previous show, where the concept of personal confidence and self-assurance was very much in the forefront of your teaching and your research and what have you. And so my question to you is having confidence and being self-assured, is that an innate skill or personality that trait that you're born with? Or can you actually improve your level of confidence and self-assurance through training, exercises, viewpoints or the like?
You can, yes. In my opinion, you absolutely can. And I think that the way that this is done is... Well, it's situational, of course. You know, you gain confidence as you, let's say, crush speeches on a stage. You gain confidence in that you can do it again. I would not have agreed with that earlier. Not necessarily that practice makes perfect, so to speak. But for me, becoming confident is the result of skill stacking. So I know that years ago, I thought public speaking was awful, horrible. There's no way I'm going to do it. I wasn't interested in doing it. Just like in high school, I thought, I'm just not good at languages. And then I moved to Germany and learned fluent German and went to a public high school there and really had a great time.
You speak 5 languages now, right?
Yes. Yeah, I speak 5 languages. So now I'm a language guy, whereas I was the worst student in my French class in middle and high school. Lo and behold, just turns out I'm not good at memorizing verb tables, which... as it turns out, is the way that 0 people learn languages naturally.
Exactly.
So, the whatever my French teacher who was educated in like 1950 had decided was a good way to learn French turns out to be a completely ineffective way for people to actually learn and practically use a language such as French. So it turned out that was a bunch of malarkey and that the real way to learn languages was to go hang out and skip school every day and play hacky sack with a bunch of street kids and learn fluent German. That was better, you know? And so I had built confidence in that area. And then it was, okay, what else can I learn? And so now when I see challenges, I attack challenges head on. Whereas I think a lot of people are taught, self-taught or otherwise, to shy away from things they cannot do because they'll get a bad grade, they'll look stupid, other people will think less of them, etc. And confidence, depending on how we define it, but for me, confidence is the idea that you know that you can try something and even if you fail, everything is going to be okay. And that is a highly prized trait. Some of the most highly compensated people in the world are salesmen, attorneys, CEOs, all of these people, one might say, are traditionally confident, but it doesn't mean that they're naturally confident. Many of those people have had to develop confidence. And me having learned sales in my own business, that was another thing I thought I would never do. I thought I'm never going to be good at sales. And then when it was, hey, you're all going to be homeless unless somebody learns sales, and my business partners buried their heads in the sand, I learned how to sell. And the sales guys training us, or me, were like, hey, you're pretty good at this. If something does happen to your company, you can come work for us. I've definitely got a job for you. And then I realized, oh, not only can I learn this skill I always thought I'd be bad at, I can take this skill anywhere because I've sold $10 million worth of whatever it is. So of course, this paper company wants me to work with them. Of course, this chemical company wants me to work with them. So you start to build confidence in areas by attacking weaknesses that you think you have and shoring them up. And also at the same time, by getting world-class at things that you enjoy and that you're really good at. I know that there's some sort of mixed messages out there. Some people will say, forget everything you're not good at, only focus on what you're great at, and that will be the way to fame and riches, so to speak. And other people say, shore up your weaknesses. I say you can do both. And you build confidence by doing both. You build confidence by being world-class at a specific set of skills. And this goes to the idea of skill stacking. I'm not the funniest guy in the world, and I never will be. I'm okay. I'm reasonably funny sometimes. I'm not the most in-depth, deep interviewer, deep thinker, but I'm reasonably deep. I do a pretty good job preparing my interviews, I'd like to think. I'm also not the most technically skilled person in the world, but I'm okay with that. I'm also not an expert internet marketer, but I'm okay with that. But when you stack all those things together, you end up with a person who is well-suited to do a podcast that is marketed online, that is run online, that is involves interviews and entertaining an audience, and just so happens to be one of the most popular shows in the world because I have stacked those skills together. If I was just trying to be the funniest person in the world, fail. If I was just trying to be the most technically inclined person in the world, fail. If I was just trying to be the deepest interviewer in the world, fail. Stack those things together at the, let's say, B plus A minus level. You've got a world-class mixture that can be a multi-7-figure income stream for the company that I'm in, and with very little competition. Well, plenty of competition, but very little in those specific areas.
Right. Well, I think it's interesting. I don't know that the public in general and attorneys in particular, whether we do enough to increase our skill sets. It's one of the reasons I think this podcast and podcasts like your own are successful in that people, I'm naturally inquisitive. I want to learn more. Always be learning is, you know, kind of what I try and live by. And it's interesting to see how you kind of relate that all the way back, that skill stacking creates confidence and self-assurance. That helps you in terms of your relationship building and networking and working on your communication skills and becoming an entrepreneur and a business leader that you can be by stacking all that up. So it's a real interesting way to kind of wrap that whole concept together.
Well, I tend to agree. I think most professions, not just picking on attorneys, I think most professionals, they don't actually do much to advance their skills. And I can't remember where I saw this. You might have seen this. There was some sort of survey among, I want to say, accounting professionals, and it was, how many books have you read this year? And the average answer was zero, or the median answer was zero, and the average was two or something like that.
Yeah.
And that's pretty bad.
Well, how often do you hear people say, I hate to read?
I get that. Yeah. And I used to hate to read. And now I read 100 plus books every year.
Yeah.
So I get it. But most people have not, and it's not just reading, it's attorneys. And look, you've been to a CLE class, right? The continuing legal education. Yeah. We all have. People are like, we need CLE credits. What sort of scam can we run where we've got pizza on Fridays and then one of the partners comes in and gives us like a completely rambly, meandering lecture about how financial derivatives work so he can get CLE credits and everybody sitting in the room can get CLE credits? It's like, shouldn't you want to learn how the new XYZ systems are working? Shouldn't you be mildly interested in copyright, patent, or trademark law? There's a lot of interesting stuff. That's why a lot of us got into the field. And here we are kind of trying to figure out how to avoid our, you know, 5 hours a year or whatever is required of us to like maintain the bare minimum of professional competence. It's a little sad. It's like, what happened? You know, we're trying to figure out our way around this requirement that is literally the bare minimum for like being a competent attorney professional.
It's an odd situation for sure. Anyway, Jordan, I want to thank you for taking the time to be with us today. It was really special for me to have you on the show, particularly our 200th episode here on The Law Entrepreneur. I want to encourage our audience to follow up and listen to your podcast if they don't already do the Jordan Harbinger Show. It's available on Apple Podcasts and Spotify and anywhere you can find podcasts. And I know you've got some courses and teachings available on your website. So I just want to direct people to your website. We'll have that in our show notes, but it's jordanharbinger.com. And you can find all that good stuff there. Any parting words for our audience?
You know, if you listen to podcasts, which you do because you're listening to one right now, I would love for people to check out the Jordan Harbinger Show. I know you said you've got that, the networking course and stuff in the show notes, so I won't bug people with that, but it's been a pleasure. I enjoy talking about this and I hope it's been helpful.
It very much has been, Jordan. So I want to thank you again for being a guest on The Law Entrepreneur. Well, that will do it, fellow law entrepreneurs, for this episode of The Law Entrepreneur. I want to thank our sponsors this week. That would be Ruby Receptionists and Jurisdiction. Be sure to visit us on our website at www.thelawentrepreneur.com or check us out on our social media platforms, Facebook, Twitter, you name it. Just search for The Law Entrepreneur. You'll find us. Make sure you consider joining our private Facebook group where we'll be having some new offerings starting the first of the year. So I want you to have a great week, and we'll see you next time. And thank you for listening to The Law Entrepreneur.